Are you in the persuasion business? Whether you realize it or not, you probably are. Whether you're motivating your team, making a big presentation, promoting your art, or advocating for social change, influencing the behavior of others is a key part of many careers. Author Marcus Collins argues that before you can successfully persuade, you have to understand the culture of your audience and speak the same cultural language. Marcus is a successful marketer and professor who has spearheaded campaigns for the likes of Beyonce, Apple, Nike, and the Brooklyn Nets. His book is called For the Culture: The Power Behind What We Buy, What We Do, and Who We Want to Be. And Marcus joins us now to share five of his big ideas.
Hi, my name is Marcus Collins, marketing professor at the Ross School of Business, University of Michigan, the head of strategy at Wieden & Kennedy, New York, and the author of For the Culture: The Power Behind What We Buy, What We Do, and Who We Want to Be. I'm going to share with you five key insights from said book. First, there's no force more influential to human behavior than culture. Second, the future of brand will be communal. Third, our approach to market segmentation is badly in need of an upgrade. Idea number four, the world is culturally constructed, so we must understand meaning. Lastly is an idea I refer to as the data paradox, where we mistake information for intimacy. Idea one, there's no force more influential to human behavior than culture. You hear that and probably think, yeah, sure, that makes sense. But if you ask five people to define culture, you'll probably get 15 different answers, and that's a problem. Without a concrete definition to describe culture, we limit our ability to operationalize its sway in our work and our day-to-day lives. The term culture finds a home in a broad array of literature, but tends to find itself in this idea of a system of beliefs, symbols, and values from which a group of people and their corresponding roles and norms are established and governed. Through this lens, culture consists of four distinct yet interrelated elements that describe its characteristics: beliefs, artifacts, behaviors, and language. The alchemy of these four characteristics is said to represent one's culture. We see it demonstrated in our ethnicities, our nationalities, religions, and passion points, whereby we invest ourselves. For instance, if you subscribe to sneaker culture, then there are beliefs, artifacts, behaviors, and language that are expected of you to be counted among the community of sneakerheads. Whether you're into skating, gaming, collecting comics, or performing cosplay, each of these collectives have cultural characteristics that are normalized within the community and expected of those who self-identify as such. Therefore, those who see themselves as a member of the community subsequently adhere to these norms to promote social solidarity among the community and remain in lockstep with their members. Naturally, this informs how they consume or what they consume. One might even argue that consumption, by its very nature, is a cultural act. What we buy, what we wear, what we drive, how we style our hair, where we go to school, who we marry, if we marry, where we vacation, even how we bury the dead. All these things are byproducts of our cultural subscription, the system of beliefs, artifacts, behaviors, and language that demarcate who we are and the expectations of people like us. And we abide by these expected conventions to stay in lockstep with our people. We buy the way our people buy. We vote the way our people vote. And we watch where our people watch. Because culture moves forward on the basis of one simple question: do people like me do something like this? If the answer is yes, we do it. If the answer is no, we don't. Therefore, if you have a vested interest in getting people to take action, then culture is your biggest cheat code. Idea two, the future of brand will be communal. The earliest established brand was founded in the 1700s by Josiah Wedgwood, who created pottery. To ensure that his pottery was not confused with other product offerings, he put his name on it and trademarked the name to signify ownership. This was how brand marketing was done in those days. You put a label on it, and it served as a legal mark. Fast forward 2.5 centuries later, to the 1950s or so, marketers got the bright idea that we can convince more people to buy by using psychology. So marketers adopted value propositions, positioning statements, and cognitive associations to create familiarity in the minds of people and instill trust. In this way, brands move beyond being a legal mark to being trust marks. You know that saying, no one ever got fired for hiring IBM? Well, why is that? because IBM can be trusted. At least that's how the saying goes, which certainly benefited the business over the years. But by the 1980s, marketers grew tired of having transactional relationships with customers. They wanted to be loved by their customers. So they used advertising to tell evocative narratives where the brand played a character in the stories to move the brand from a trust mark to a love mark. Now, today's most powerful brands leverage culture to connect with people because of its connection to identity, where people consume as identity projects to express who they are to the world. These brands have evolved beyond love marks to becoming identity marks. And if that be the case, then tomorrow's brands will be all about community. Aristotle said it best, man by nature is a social animal. We're tribal in nature, given to gathering and communing in familiar groups. We want to belong. As we use brands to say something about who we are, we then find people just like us to form community. In this way, brands will transcend from being an identity mark to being a tribal mark, where people within the community share a worldview and abide by the same cultural conventions and expectations. Today's technology actually facilitates this evolution of brand with more decentralized networks like Web 3.0 and greater media fragmentation. And the brands who are able to facilitate these communities will win, while the ones who are still worried about value propositions and making the logo bigger, those brands will lose. Idea 3, our approach to marketing segmentation is badly in need of an upgrade. Marketers typically rely on demographics to describe people based on their age, race, gender, household income, geography, and education. Demographics provide discrete boxes to put people in and help us make the world meet. But here's the thing. Demographics, while factual in most cases, don't actually describe who people are. Take my demographics, for example. I'm African American. I'm 44 years old. I'm from Detroit, Michigan, born and raised, and went to public schools my entire life. If a marketer saw this description of me, my demographics, as their target interest, they would likely put me in a box based on the stereotypes they have constructed in their minds about what 40-something black men who live in Detroit do or would likely to do. Like, what if I told you that Deborah drives a minivan? You likely think that she has kids and plays soccer and probably live in the suburbs. These depictions aren't true, but they are easy. And we rely on these cognitive shortcuts all the time. That goes for marketers and non-marketers alike. We say things like all women love to shop or all black people do something, fill in the blank, something racist. Not because it's true, but because it's easy. Well, yes, I am 44 years old, I am black, I am from Detroit, and I did attend public schools my entire life. None of this gets to the fact that I grew up playing jazz as a kid, or that I swam competitively from age 6 through high school. I wrote love songs for a living in my 20s and grew up loving the Monkees just as much as I love the Tribe Called Quest. These experiences help shape how I see the world, which ultimately informs how I behave in the world. Demographics never get anywhere close to capturing those nuances that make me who I am. However, my tribal communities do, which make these networks groups that we're a part of a better means of segmenting the market than demographics. Plus, people don't even self-identify by demographics. We self-identify by our communities and adhere to the cultural characteristics of our communities. Therefore, our behaviors are much more likely to be predictive of the behaviors of people like us than they will these functional, fictional boxes that we put people in. Demographics do a terrible job of describing real people. Cultural communities, on the other hand, are far more accurate and predictable. Idea 4, the world is culturally constructed. That is to say, things aren't the way they are the way that we are. Reality is subjective and meaning is not fixed. Take, for instance, the color red. What does it mean? It's an odd question, I know, but humor me. One may say red is a color. Someone may say that red is a wavelength that activates one's eyes to see a color. But red doesn't inherently have meaning. However, if you're driving down the street and you approach a red light at an intersection, red means stop. Why? Because we have collectively agreed that red means stop, just as green means go and yellow means slow down. Unless you're like me, yellow means hurry up. But red also means passion. It also means danger. It also means hot and angry and sexy. Red has many different meanings, but none of them are inherent to the word. These are the meanings that we as a society have constructed to be signified by the color red. Ferdinand de Saussure, one of the founding fathers of semiotics, once said that everything around us is inherently meaningless. And it's true. Look around you. Everything your eye can see at this very moment has no intrinsic meaning. Instead, we collectively negotiated and decided its meaning. That's why for some, a cow is leather, for some it's dinner, and for others it's a deity. Which one is true? Well, all of them. Because meaning is not fixed. It is culturally mediated based on how we see the world and how we translate the world through our cultural frames. Now, there's a big takeaway here for marketers and managers and leaders alike, that we as brands, as companies, as organizations, as institutions, we don't make meaning. We signal meaning. And people collectively decide what it means. See, take marketing, for instance. We own the brand mark, we own the products, and we own its expression. But what it means, how it's translated in the minds of people, and whether it's adopted and accepted, is all based on the people. The anthropologist Clifford Geertz says meaning is the system through which we live and by its very nature, the collective property of the group. Just like creative expression, the author, the artist, has no sovereignty over his or her own work, images, or sound. It belongs to the reader who interprets it. It belongs to the people. The same thing goes with brand communications. Meanings interpret in the minds of the people. Therefore, understanding how people make meaning will increase the likelihood of understanding who they are and how they navigate the world around them so that we might be able to influence them to take action, to move. Idea 5. We have more information than ever before, yet we still struggle to understand consumers. That's because we mistake information for intimacy. We live in a hyper-connected world where there's more data collected than ever before. Every Google search, every credit card swipe, every authored tweet leaves behind a breadcrumb of information that amounts to reams and reams of data in aggregate. However, though the amount of data available to marketers have increased exponentially over time, our ability to extract insight from said data has only marginally increased. This paradox amounts to a simple yet significant oversight on behalf of most marketers. We mistake information for intimacy. We have a ton of information, but not much intimacy. Take LinkedIn, for example. Before an important meeting, you'll likely go to LinkedIn to learn about the person you'll be speaking with. However, you don't get to know the person until you've interacted with them, exchanged ideas, or observed their mannerisms. These details are only reserved once you move beyond the statistical details of that person. To know people requires intimacy, a closeness that traditional data metrics will never provide. We know this intuitively. However, when we get in the boardroom, we take off our human hat in exchange for our marketing hat and leave our humanity at the door. It's time that we got more human. Site traffic, engagement across social networking platforms, purchases, and search queries can reveal quite a bit about consumers' interests, preferences, and desires. That's a good thing. Yet, despite having all this information, marketers still struggle to understand their customers, to understand people. How can this be? It's because search history, purchase history, and site traffic are not who people are. They're merely what people do. To understand who people are, we have to get much closer. We have to get intimate. It's sort of like flying over New York City. You fly over New York City, you can see the relationships between different parts of the city. You can see the patterns. Oh, here is Central Park. Here's Times Square. Here's Meatpacking. And here's the Financial District. But you don't know the city until you walk the streets. You don't know the city until you talk to people. You don't know the city until you know how the city moves, its train system. And what is the system that moves people? Culture. We don't know people until we know their cultural subscription, the beliefs that shape the way they see the world, the artifacts that have meaning, the behaviors that are normative, and the language that they use. To understand this requires great proximity, tremendous, tremendous intimacy. And information alone won't get us there. Thanks for listening. I truly hope you enjoy the book.
Thank you, Marcus. That was Marcus Collins with 5 big ideas from For the Culture, the power behind what we buy, what we do, and who we want to be. You might also like our book bite for Magic Words, What to Say to Get Your Way by Jonah Berger. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.